Hello and welcome to No Character Limit. My name is Robert Thurk, and today you're going to hear episode 20 of my book entitled Ultima Thule: Unraveling the Unknown. In this episode, we're going to finish up chapter 12, which is called The Faith, Facts, and Pseudoscience of Meteorites. In the last episode, we explored the possible relationship between ancient people and meteorites, and we are going to continue that exploration in this episode. But I also mentioned that there is another theme that needs to be discussed here relating to the role of speculation and pseudoscience. In the last episode, I brought up an author, Robert Bavall, who attempted to align the pyramids with Orion's Belt and associate the Benben Stone with a meteorite. Personally, I don't know enough about the situation to know how strong Bavall's argument can be, but there have been at least a few professional astronomers that have pushed back on his ideas as presuming too much. On one hand, if Bavall's theory is true, he's going to really need more evidence to prove it. And that evidence is unlikely to ever be there this far into the future from when the pyramids were built. But on the other hand, what if he had a point and the scientists were the ones that were being too hard-headed about this? That balance is the one that I'm going to try and strike in this episode, because there's nothing wrong with entertaining an idea, no matter how wild and speculative it is, but entertaining an idea should be very different than believing in it. On the other hand, sometimes, as we're going to find out today, scientists can be wrong. So how do we know what to believe? I hope that by the end of this episode, everybody can take something away and learn something about how they are viewing different situations and how balanced their view is being. Speculation can be a lot like an addictive drug that is hard to escape and can even be weaved into our most trusted resources. Later on in this series, in another episode, I'm going to share a story where I almost fell victim to a pseudoscientific article that was actually peer-reviewed. So I'm not saying I'm immune to missing this balance, especially with the wide range of topics that I discuss on this podcast. Please reach out to me if you've ever noticed that I'm inaccurately sharing something as fact that shouldn't be because of something that I overlooked or didn't research deeply enough into. And this is a good point to remind you that I always share my sources for free in the description of the podcast. But in this episode, I'm going to discuss them with a little bit more depth and detail to help get some important points across about reliability and common mistakes. In the last episode, we explored a lot of enticing speculation on the relationship between ancient people and meteorites. But there was not a lot of solid evidence to truly know their impact. So I'm going to try and come at this from a different angle. I'm going to share a story on the impact of a meteorite during the Middle Ages in Europe that is well documented. The latter half of this episode is going to focus on the story of the Ensisheim meteorite, the earliest known meteorite landfall that was witnessed in recorded history, and how it confounded everyone involved for centuries, while simultaneously helping to push scientific understanding forward. One of my favorite historical figures that I introduce in this episode is Ernst Chladni, who I bring up again later in the book. He not only played an important role in the history of our understanding of meteors, but he was also great at understanding how sound worked. And I always appreciate someone who is able to work across multiple disciplines, as Chladni did. So let's get into it. Please like, rate, review, or tell a friend if you've been enjoying this podcast. You can always give a donation. With every donation, I give a free PDF copy of my book, which includes a lot of pictures and descriptions that I don't talk about in the podcast. You can follow me at No Character Limit at mastodon.world for updates. And you can always reach out to me, especially if you notice that I've made an error, at No Character Limit at protonmail.com. So let's finish up chapter 12, The Faith, Facts, and Pseudoscience of Meteorites. Chapter 12, Part 3, Speculative Prophet, The Allure of Meteoritic Pseudoscience. Speculation does have an essential role in pushing the understanding of history or science, but speculation should also be clearly stated. Conspiracy theories abound about the pyramids, the Benben stone, and meteorite worship by ancient cultures. Some claim that the Benben stone was the Betel stone that the biblical Jacob laid his head upon. The Eye of Providence, also known as the All-Seeing Eye of God, is found within a Benben stone on top of a pyramid on the Great Seal of the United States. This sort of iconography leads countless down steep paths of tempting half-truths and bold-faced lies. Authors spin spurious claims far more provocative than Bavall and make significant profit from it. One of the most popular shows on the History Channel, Ancient Aliens, gained notoriety for indulging the conspiratorial mind. Programs like that not only minimize the efforts of our ancestors, but manipulate viewers to consider profitable and baseless entertainment to be equal to the expertise of professionals. A theory such as the one Bavall puts forth on the organization of the pyramids being made in the image of the sky is not as extreme as most, but it is an excellent reminder at how easy it is for us to see what we want to see, even when nothing is there. It's exactly this slippery slope that makes researching ancient meteorite worship so difficult that even reliable sources can often share wrong information. Unreliable sources will state with overconfidence that their fantasy-laden desires and couched half-truths are facts. One resource I use to help orient my understanding of ancient cultures' meteorite worships was an article written by Matthew Flax on the website Owlcation, which posits itself as a site created by educators and experts on topics related to education as a place to share expertise and knowledge about all things academic. Flax's article was a great diving off point with a lot of good evidence-based information. For example, there is a great story Flax relays about a space Buddha statue known as Iron Man. It was discovered as part of a Nazi expedition to Tibet in order to feed Hitler's obsession for ancient artifacts and desire to find the roots of the Aryan people. Flax's article goes on to cite an article from September of 2012 in space.com, a relatively reliable source of how this intricately carved Buddha likely caught the attention of the Nazis because of a huge swastika emblazoned on its chest. The article goes on to say that it was likely carved over 1,000 years ago and came from an iron meteorite that crashed 10,000 years ago. The Nazis allegedly brought this rare ancient artifact back to Germany, where it landed in the hands of a private owner until 2007. At which point small samples of the statue began to be collected and was conclusively determined to be made from a meteorite. Space.com even goes on to use direct quotes from the researchers in the Scientific Journal of Meteoritics and Planetary Science that states, quote, "One can speculate whether the swastika symbol on the statue was a potential motivation to displace the Iron Man meteorite artifact to Germany." End quote. In September of 2012, variations of this story spread throughout all of the scientific outlets and was what inspired a portion of Flax's Owlcation article. But by October, it appeared that something was off about this story. While the Iron Man statue was definitely made of an iron meteorite with a high quantity of nickel, its origin of being about 1,000 years old started to come into question. National Geographic's original September 2012 article was updated in October of the same year to indicate that the statue may have been created as late as the 20th century. Sci-fi.com, of all sources, went on to produce an article in December of 2012 stating that a professor in Buddhism studies in South Korea took a closer look and noted multiple inconsistencies in the statue compared to what we would typically expect to find from that time period. The expert noted that its shoes, trousers, cape, beard, and sleeve seemed inconsistent with Tibetan artifacts that date back to that time period. The researchers acknowledged in their original article in the Journal of Meteoritics and Planetary Science that its dating was only preliminary, and welcomed feedback from a scholar of culture, which is exactly what happened in the months following the big September story. With the Iron Man's age being thrown into question, the entire origin of this mysterious space Buddha became more suspect. But Flax didn't follow up with the developments of the Iron Man space Buddha, even though he wrote his owlocation article well after December of 2012. This may be because the article that he does link is the space.com article rather than the National Geographic or Sci-Fi article. Could Flax have researched more in depth? Yes, but everyone could always do deeper research on a topic. It seems Flax unwittingly had propagated a false story that gained clicks rather than take the time to delve into the much more convoluted origin of the carving. It was a statue made of meteorite, but the entire Nazi collection story around it is what gave it mystique. And this seemed to be the part that Flax didn't get right. Flax goes on to make a few more errors about other meteorites in his article that deeper research would have prevented. He mentions that the carving of Artemis at the Temple of Artemis, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, had been documented in ancient text as having, quote, fallen from Jupiter, end quote, which may indicate that the Artemis carving was a meteorite. He also mentions the famed Omphalos stone at Apollo's temple at Delphi, which was considered by the ancient Greeks to be the navel of the world, to have also possibly been of meteoritic origin. If true, the Omphalos stone could have been associated with the Greeks, as the Benben was to the Egyptians, or the Black Stone is with Muslims. But there was more information that Flax did not know or include in his article. In the scientific journal Popular Astronomy, an article by C.C. Wiley and J.R. Naden entitled "The Image Which Fell Down from Jupiter" goes into the unusual phrasing of how the origin of the image of Artemis was literally translated as having fallen from the sky, which at first would give credence to the idea that it was made of a meteorite. But then the article goes on to give multiple direct quotes from ancient sources that the image of Artemis was actually carved out of wood. They also go on to explain how words and phrases can take on different meanings in cultural contexts, such as someone who has a Bachelor of Science can very easily still be a woman with very little scientific knowledge. Basically, direct translations are not always accurate. They mention how there are many objects that have been said to have fallen from Jupiter that may simply mean that they were just merely sacred objects. The fact that multiple ancient primary resources who saw the image with their own eyes described that it was made of wood should be enough to dispel the belief that it could be a meteorite when there is no contradicting direct evidence of it. Any belief that the Omphalos was a meteorite is based on similarly thin evidence as the image of Artemis. But Flax only hints that these may have been meteorites based on some ancient tantalizing clues before moving on and stays away from any sort of definitive or in-depth claims. One great article that discusses potential Greek and Roman meteorites is the Meteor Beliefs Project, Meteorite Worship in the Ancient Greek and Roman Worlds, published in the scientific journal WGN, Journal of the International Meteor Organization, where they break down several of the most famous potential meteorites or meteoritical objects of the ancient classical world, including the image of Artemis at her temple. They break down the language of what the phrase "fallen from Jupiter" means and discuss several ancient objects that allegedly fell from Jupiter and placed them on a scale between less likely to be a meteorite, such as the shield of Ancile and the image of Artemis, and more likely to be a meteorite, like the large stone of Aegospotami and the Magna Mater, with several other objects falling somewhere between. Of all of these, the authors point out that the Magna Mater was the best candidate for most worshipped potential meteorite, but there are some reservations on whether this was definitively true or not. The authors admit that all of the texts claiming that it fell from the sky came notably later in the Magna Mater's existence. They consider that the Magna Mater stone may be conflated in these ancient texts with the Aegospotami Fall, a near-certain meteorite, but one that was definitely not worshipped. The Magna Mater stone was described as relatively small, but was likely a part of a larger statue that made up the goddess of the Magna Mater herself. Magna Mater, Roman for Great Mother, was only the latest iteration of one of the oldest cults of antiquity. With much fanfare, her statue and stone were brought from Phrygia, where she was worshipped as Cybele. Like Artemis of Ephesus, Cybele also had a strong Anatolian influence. Allegedly, her power was so great that her priests would castrate themselves at her image. But her primary followers were women, as she represented some of the most primordial feminine forces of the universe. Priestesses would celebrate her mystique by keeping her secrets hidden behind locked doors, and one of her major celebrations happened right around the spring equinox. It is possible that she was worshipped for thousands of years, even before her statue came to Rome. When her image arrived in Rome from the east, it was a highly celebrated event, with many natural phenomena allegedly occurring to hearken her arrival. A lightning strike at a city gate, a meteor crossing the sky, and even a sighting of two suns, all were claimed to have been seen as Magna Mater approached the historic city. Its description was black, which would match a meteorite. But just like with so many other dark stones of religious worship, the authors conclude that we will never know for certain whether the Magna Mater image included a meteorite. But reasonable academic and scientific reflection about what is known about Magna Mater and its potential relationship to being a meteorite can quickly spin out of control into total pseudoscience, a profitable yet hollow endeavor. When searching for the Magna Mater, one self-described writer and TV presenter of historical mysteries, Andrew Goff, has a website dedicated to pseudoscience, which includes an entire entry on the Magna Mater. Goff seems to have an unusual obsession with honeybees, decorating his website design in hexagonal honeycomb shapes and a tomb covered in bees as its most prominently featured image. Goff associates the Magna Mater as the goddess of bees, but whether or not this is true, I could not verify that from anywhere else. This alone doesn't mean he's wrong, and it may mean I'm missing the resource he's using, but he doesn't stop there. There is a lot that Goff puts forth with colorful details that are not easily verified, including speaking about the Magna Mater as if being made of a meteorite was an absolute certainty in his article entitled "The Goddess Who Fell to Earth," where he claims confidently that, quote, "a stone from heaven is nothing if not a meteorite," end quote. In a day and age where it's so easy to misinterpret long-dead cultures with our modern and creative minds, Goff seems to hold no hesitation within his writing when spinning his narrative. That Goff can write about ancient history with such colorful detail should be a warning sign that he may not be the most reliable resource. Goff speaks with the confidence of a researcher, but with none of the credentials. Yet Goff's cavalier attitude towards history isn't shunned by modern society. It is instead rewarded and given multiple television contracts. His website has a long list of poorly evidenced historical mystery shows that are easily accessible to most people who have access to television. He has pumped out over 30 shows over the last decade, like The Alaska Triangle and Conspiracies Decoded. And in both write-ups, he makes sure to call the COVID pandemic a scamdemic. These shows are regularly presented on channels like Travel Channel and Discovery Science, despite Goff repeatedly avoiding anything that could be considered respect for science. Using the cover of words like forbidden, mysteries, and hidden, he is able to spin colorful fictions and present them as possible facts in the same way that ancient aliens pioneered this whole generation of these pseudo-scientific historical mystery shows. Goff mixes the truth with lies like bankers mixed good and bad loans leading up to the 2008 financial crisis, and are altogether a different level of inaccurate reporting than the likes of an imperfect but relatively accurate reporting from Flax on owlcation. While Flax may be guilty of not researching deeply enough into scientific reporting, Goth picks and chooses what he wants to believe and fills in the gaps with anything he wants. Articles like Flax's do not cross the egregious lines that articles by Goff do. Goff is in the business of world building, with stories similar to those found in Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, or Game of Thrones. But Goff shamelessly maps his fictional world onto our real one, and goes about trying to convince others that they're true. Goff shares more similarities with L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, than he does with any expert in the area of history. And Goff is not the only one in the business profiting from fiction paraded as fact. Researching any of these topics on ancient history, it is almost inevitable that you will stumble upon the website Ancient Origins, run by a woman known as April Holloway, another non-academic who posits herself as an authority on ancient history. Many of these topics, including the Omphalos being a meteorite and the Benben Stone's power, are covered on Ancient Origins. The topics covered on Ancient Origins are much more narrative in nature and doesn't tend to be corroborated by more academic resources. There is also a lot of uncontroversial information mixed in as well, which makes the speculations packaged as truths or likely truths all the more dangerous. One of the biggest warning signs is the amount of fringe advertisement that covers every free square inch of the site. There is no doubt that many people have found themselves interested on a topic of ancient times and got their information from the digestible and fantastical Ancient Origins, coming to believe it as truth. On MediaBiasFactCheck.com, Ancient Origins is classified as a conspiracy pseudoscience website, having mixed factual reporting. One of the other websites Holloway writes for, where she often includes articles from Ancient Origins, is the Epoch Times, which MediaBiasFactCheck.com classifies as a questionable source, also with mixed factual reporting. The reality remains that we will never truly know how the role of meteorites impacted ancient civilization. Meteorite artifacts like King Tut's meteorite dagger or beaded irons found in necklaces and belts in ancient Egypt give us tantalizing artifacts that prove that they played some role. Ancient cultures like the abandoned temples around Lonar Lake or celebrations of the Meriam-Mer people prove that meteorites can have a powerful sway over the faithful. But whether something like the Benben Stone was a meteorite that pulled together one of the most powerful civilizations in ancient history to inspire the shape of the pyramids, or whether it was not at all like that, can never truly be known. Speculation can be irresistible, and it is good to indulge in it as it gives our imagination the ability to explore unconventional ideas. But be wary of those who attempt to spin their speculation into gold. Chapter 12, Part 4, Faith and Facts in Ensisign, The Birth of Meteoritics. But we don't have to look so far back in time to see the influence of meteorites on the human psyche. The earliest recorded meteorite sighting in Europe that was witnessed to crash to the Earth was on November 7th, 1492, in Ensisheim, Alsace, located just west of the Rhine in what is today part of France. Just before noon on that fateful day, the people of Alsace had their attention brought to the sky by the fiery arrival of a chondrite meteor that had chanced upon entering Earth's atmosphere only moments before. The drawn-out explosive sound of what would become the coveted Ensisheim meteorite was heard for hundreds of miles around, and nobody knew what had created this disturbing blast in an age where gunpowder was still in its infancy in Europe. Everyone was confused. That is, except for a singular boy who came excitedly running into town to bring the people to the source of this loud and mysterious explosive sound. The boy led people to a hole in the middle of a wheat field where he had witnessed the meteorite hit the ground with his own eyes. A nearly impossible sighting. Despite the countless reports of meteors in ancient times, most average people in Europe in the 15th century were not aware of the existence of meteors at all. So this giant rock that had fallen out of the sky perplexed the gathering community around this muddy hole in the middle of the wheat field. The meteorite was described to weigh nearly 300 pounds, with a triangular shape and three sharp corners, that common shape of many meteorites due to fluid dynamics, similar to the description of the Benben stone. Immediately, mystical significance was imbued onto the rock, and after pulling it from the earth, people began chipping off pieces of it for good luck. But they were quickly stopped by a local official who brought it to the Ensisheim Parish Church for preservation. It was decided that they would wait for the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian, who happened to be arriving in the town later that month, to battle the French to see what he wanted to be done about this mystifying triangular boulder that fell from the sky. Ensisheim's location being right on the border of what is today France and Germany has made it central to war efforts between these two cultures for centuries. When King Maximilian arrived, he was just as wonderstruck by the miraculous skyrock as the locals were. After taking it for a short while, Maximilian deemed the meteorite to be a signal of God's favor for him to overcome the French, and struck off two fragments for the Archduke of Austria and himself before heading off to battle, where he did ultimately defeat the French. he returned the stone to Ensisheim, where he ordered it to be preserved as an eternal testimony to what had happened. And today, the meteorite can still be visited in this very same town over 500 years later. Unlike the cryptic, unreliable, and highly misinterpreted reporting from ancient times, the Ensisheim meteorite has a variety of sources that help corroborate the reaction to what happened when it fell. Since the meteorite is still intact today, it has been definitively proven to have come from the sky. The reason why so many sources on the meteorite exist is primarily because it was the first time that a meteorite was observed striking the Earth since the advent of the printing press a half century before. Broadsheets with poems were printed claiming that the event was, quote, a sign of divine favor toward King Maximilian and an evil omen for his enemies, end quote, which included both France and the Turks. Woodcuts and paintings followed, commemorating the event. It may have been the first sensationalized report that captured the attention of most of Europe since the printing press was invented. It's not difficult, then, to see how people that lived thousands of years before this time, whether it was the ancient Greeks, Romans, Egyptians, or whoever, would have imbued divine meaning into their own meteoritic events, just as Europeans did with Ensisheim. The fall at Ensisheim inspired countless fantasy-based stories, much like the ones spun by Holloway's Ancient Origins or Goff's television specials today. But unlike today, nearly all Europeans had lost whatever knowledge or wisdom the ancients had about meteorites and did not understand even the most fundamental aspects about them. When Conrad Gesner, so brilliant he was sometimes referred to as the Swiss Pliny, received a piece of Ensisheim over 70 years later in the 16th century, he propagated the false belief that other objects such as shark's teeth, fossils, and prehistoric axe heads had also fallen from the sky. Even a brilliant man such as Gesner missed an opportunity to develop a deeper understanding of meteorites in favor of a fiction that felt right to him. The meteorite survived through the wars that ravaged the French-German border in the 17th century. And by the 18th century, it was seen as an object of ridicule by the likes of Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and other intellectuals of the time. Brilliant minds dismissed the centuries of superstition brought by a mere rock, which many didn't even believe fell from the sky anymore by that point. When the mayor and most prominent citizens of a town in southern France testified with a notarized document that a shower of stones had struck their village in 1790, one scientific editor wrote, quote, "How sad is it not to see a whole municipality attempt to certify the truth of a physically impossible phenomenon?" End quote. Many scientists of the time still believed that rocks broke from mountains or were flung from distant volcanoes or hurled through the atmosphere by hurricanes to explain such phenomena. beliefs that were held since ancient times. It wasn't until 1794 when the German physicist Ernst Chladni decided to research and publish a small book on the topic of meteorites, which came to be so important that he has since been labeled as the father of meteoritics. This honor was given to him even after he was already known as the father of acoustics. He gained this title by visualizing sound through sprinkling powder on a plate to show how different vibrations gave different shapes to the powder, a phenomenon now known as Chladni figures. His work with sound went even further than that, having also discovered the speed of sound for different gases. If all of these accomplishments weren't enough, his least notable achievement was that he was also a lawyer. By the time he focused on the mystery of meteorites, he was already well established in law and acoustics. His interest in meteorites was inspired when he had a conversation with a professor of physics that had witnessed a fireball and posited the idea that these rocks could have extraterrestrial origin. Chladni collected what he considered to be the most reliable eyewitness reports of fireballs and falling rocks over the previous several centuries, and he wrote his book. Included in his book was the eyewitness report of the famed Ensisheim Stone. Chladni concluded that these rocks must be the result of some cosmic bodies plunging into the atmosphere at speeds much greater than anything on Earth was capable of doing on its own. Despite only using eyewitness accounts, Chladni was able to surmise the origins of meteorites with relative accuracy. Chladni's 1794 book was at first received with skepticism and ridicule, but within the next year, the heavens made his theory harder to ignore. A report of stones falling in Italy and a 56-pound rock crashing to the ground in England that landed so close to a farmer he was covered in mud caused enough interest to take Chladni's idea more seriously. These events, along with Chladni's book, got the attention of the Royal Society in Britain, where a chemist by the name of Edward Howard was tasked to study the chemical composition of these alleged sky rocks. Howard worked with the French mineralogist Jacques-Louis de Bernin to complete the first scientific analysis of meteorites, finding the chondrules of the stony meteorites and the unusually high composition of nickel in the iron meteorites, both signs indicating that they were not of earthly origins. The composition of these rocks were unlike anything else found on Earth. These findings were published in 1802 and fully supported the acoustic physicist's theory, thus earning Chladni the title that connected him to the origin of meteoritic science. At the same time as the Royal Society study in Britain, the Ensisheim meteorite was also being chemically analyzed by a professor of chemistry at the Central School of the High Rhine in France, where Chladni's beliefs were not yet accepted. The professor concluded that Ensisheim was merely a stone that had fallen down a nearby mountain, and that the claims of a single boy centuries before was completely unreliable. These results were published in 1800, 2 years before the Royal Society's review. He believed there was too much superstition attached to the stone, and that it was good science to attribute the cause to a known event. The stone having merely fallen down the side of a nearby mountain and somehow ending up in the field was the most parsimonious explanation for it, which is typically considered good science. And so here we see that it is possible to be not imaginative enough. The opposite problem of imbuing objects with divine or supernatural meaning, as those believed for centuries beforehand. Scientists can get tunnel vision by discounting repeated credible anecdotal accounts and searching for an already known answer to the unknown phenomena. This professor of the High Rhine would have likely been privy to Chladni's book, the meteoritic events in Italy and England, as well as a meteor shower that was reported globally in India only 2 years earlier. But this was also a time of competing theories. And even Edward Howard of the Royal Society compared his own work with the French study done on the Ensisheim stone. Howard indicated that the stone in Ensisheim was very consistent with the other meteorites he and Burnin had analyzed for the Royal Society. The culminating evidence indicated that the French study was incorrect, despite it being more parsimonious and based on good knowledge of the time. Further studies were done on the Ensisheim stone, and by 1803, it was determined by another analysis that the, quote, stone had a perfect resemblance to all the stones said to have fallen from the clouds, end quote. In that same year, another meteorite shower in Normandy laid to rest any doubt of Chladni's theory. In the ensuing years, there was a scientific excitement about meteorites and their origins based on Chladni's ideas. In 1807, there was a witnessed meteorite fall that occurred in Weston, Connecticut, where a 37-pound rock was recovered from an oat field. The specimen was brought to New York for verification by Dr. Archibald Bruce, who had a piece of the Ensisheim meteorite in his possession for comparison. Thanks to Ensisheim, Bruce deemed the first known recovered meteorite of the Americas to be legitimate. Chladni himself began collecting meteorite specimens after the success of his book and ultimately obtained his own piece of the Ensisheim meteorite and visited the main stone in 1810. By this time, the stone had lost over 150 pounds from all the pieces taken from it, and today the Ensisheim stone is only about 120 pounds, compared to its original weight of nearly 300 pounds. Although it was temporarily removed to other locations, the stone was still housed in the Ensisheim Parish Church until the building collapsed in 1854. Despite the church surviving multiple wars and attacks on the village, the centuries-old building succumbed to its age, and the meteorite was recovered and moved to the nearby hotel, where it can still be visited to this day. Outlasting man-made structures is something most meteorites are quite good at. After the relocation, the meteorite went on to survive two world wars and was most recently featured in the aforementioned Herzog Fireball documentary. Herzog also makes his way to the observatory at Castel Gandolfo in Fireball, where they meet a Jesuit scientist named Brother Guy Consolmagno, who is in charge of keeping the Vatican's meteorite collection and maintaining the papal observatory. The interviewer asks Guy, quote, "When you see a shooting star today, is it an interesting scientific fact for you, or do you gasp in wonder?" End quote. And Guy responds, quote, "Yes, it is both. And frankly, I think it's because I know the science that I'm even more in awe. All of that adds to the joy. It doesn't take away from it." End quote. Guy also provides some insight as to how the ancients might have felt witnessing a meteor or comet in the sky when the interviewer mentions how Guy had seen Comet West in the 1970s. Shortly after witnessing the comet, Guy said, quote, "Was it impressive? No, it was frightening," end quote. And that seeing it shook him to the core. In Fireball, when Guy was asked to expound upon what he meant when he said that all of those years ago, he stated, quote, "In the sky was a comet that looked like every photograph of a comet you'd ever seen. The kind of thing that you thought only existed in photographs. And it didn't belong there. And it was big, and it was scary, and it wasn't there yesterday, and what is going on?" And then you understood why ancient people would look at comets as a portent of something really, really scary and different. End quote. As a deeply religious man, Brother Guy had found a way to bridge the gap between science and faith. Ancient and modern, traditional and radical, by accepting the universe as it is to become closer to God. He says, quote, "You can't do science. You don't want to do science if you don't have that sense of awe, that sense of wonder. You can't believe in a creator God without experiencing creation. Otherwise, what's the point of believing?" End quote. In contrast to the fundamentalist backlash when the Martian meteorite from Allen Hills was thought to potentially hold a clue to life on other planets, and the church's reaction to the heliocentric model of the universe backed by Galileo, the Catholic Church has come to be more accepting of the facts of the universe, even those that challenge the writings of the Bible. In 2012, Pope Benedict came to Castel Gandolfo to hold a meteorite from Mars, and in doing so, demonstrated an acceptance of science, a direct contrast to the anti-science mentality of popes like Gregory XIII during the age of Lilius. In 2018, the Jesuits running the observatory held the first ever workshop in coordinating, curation, and conservation of the world's collection of meteorites. Understanding and revering God's true creation through science still has a place in the hearts of the faithful, like those of Brother Guy. Meteorites like Ensisheim have led people to believe in divine providence, as well as act as a conduit for science to better understand our universe. The religious can err, just as Maximilian did when he believed the rock was a divine sign of his victory over France. But they can also lead to deeper understanding, just as the study of meteorites by Jesuit priests like Brother Guy have done. Scientists can blunder just as easily, as the French study that was conducted on Ensisheim tried to dismiss its fantastical origin. But science, with some imagination, can lead to breakthroughs, like Chladni's book and Howard's analysis on Ensisheim did. No matter our faith, career, or knowledge, we have to be open enough to understanding when we might be wrong, especially when we are certain that we are right. And if Ensisheim could do this to the Europeans of the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th century, then we can truly only speculate on the impression that any witnessed meteor fall would have had on the ancient world. Thank you for listening to this episode of No Character Limit. Every episode, the sources that I used are located in the description if you would like to check them out. In addition, please consider liking, rating, and reviewing if you enjoyed this podcast, as each one goes to help further the reach of this podcast for new people to hear. Each episode requires hours in research, writing, recording, and editing. So if you feel that what you just heard is worth a donation of any size, please go to the description and follow the links for that. Each donation comes with a free PDF copy of a writing piece of your choice, no matter the size of your donation, and you get a lot of extra features with that, including a lot of the artwork and graphs and pictures, as well as the descriptions that I don't include in the podcast. If you would like updates for new episodes, you can follow No Character Limit at mastodon.world. And finally, if you have a question, comment, or even a correction, please feel free to reach out at nocharacterlimit@protonmail.com. Thank you again for listening.